So open up your Bibles to Genesis 12. If you're not already there. Just kind of picking up where we had left off Genesis in the summer, I think, when we kind of went through the first 11 chapters. Now the story begins. It kind of starts all over again with God's call of Abram. Abram, from what we learned last week, he was living in the land of the Chaldeans. So he was a Babylonian. While he was there, he was participating probably in worshiping the moon god, which is who the Babylonians worshipped. And God, in God's wisdom and his providence and his plan, was to call this one man, his family, out from Chaldea and bring him into the land of promise and to kind of start over with Abram, with one man, one wife who couldn't have children, was barren, and start over. And with Abram, he's given new promises. He's given these promises specifically to Abram, that he is going to make Abram into a great nation. So this man, 75 years old, his wife, 65 years old, who can't bear children, he's going to multiply their descendants. So there's going to be a number of offspring that flow from this barren old couple. Another promise was that he's going to make Abram, his name, great. So in contrast to those of the Tower of Babel, God is starting over with Abram. The people of the Tower of Babel wanted to make their name great. God chooses one person out from among that scattered people, and he takes Abram and says he's going to make Abram's name great. So Abram is going to be a man that's known, a man that's respected, a man that has, most likely, this ties into kingship, those that are in authority that flow from Abram. Some of his offspring are going to be rulers. Another one of those promises is a blessing. God promises to bless Abram and to bless those who bless Abram. He promises that he will curse those who curse Abram. But ultimately, he promises that all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. So God scattered the families of the earth on the plains of Shinar, the Tower of Babel. He chose one person out from among the scattered peoples, and through that one person, he would bring blessing to the rest. And ultimately, we see at the end of the Bible, we see how that promise is fulfilled in Jesus. That's God's great secret, mysterious plan that he begins working out to provide salvation, blessing for all the nations of the earth. So we see that God is calling Abram out from his homeland to relocate to the land of promise. And Abraham displays faith in answering God's call and following God's word and obeying the Lord who's called him out. What we see here in the end of chapter 12 is not necessarily the same type of faith that we saw at the beginning of chapter 12. So Abram, now this displays this kind of radical faith to relocate his entire family, to follow God's call, to go to a place he didn't know, and to be a sojourner in the land. This Abram, who tours the Holy Land, if you will, and sets up altars on the north end and the south end and worships Yahweh in the land, this Abram who displayed that type of faith is now going to encounter a test. And this seems to be a pattern that God works within his people. Often, after displays of radical faith, of perhaps radical deliverance or special favor, God's people enter into a period of testing or a time or occasion of testing. And this test is designed to expose, to reveal, to bring things to light. It's designed to purify God's people, to strengthen them. It's designed to humble them and bring them before the Lord and force them to depend upon him. This test is what God brings Abram into, and it's not what you would expect. If you just simply read through the beginning of chapter 12 and you get to the middle of chapter 12, you realize that something has occurred that is not what we expected. God promised to bless Abram. He promised to give him this land. He promised to multiply his descendants. And then what happens immediately? A severe famine strikes the land of promise. So So there is no food. It's severe enough that threatens, most likely, it threatens Abram's livelihood. It perhaps would even threaten his life if there is no food for them to eat. And this is the test that God has brought about to test Abram's faith, to test his loyalty. Does he believe God's promises? Does he believe that God, if God gave a promise, that he will keep that promise? He will keep Abram alive, give him descendants, give the land to his offspring, and bring blessing upon him. So, how does Abram fare? Let's look at this a little bit more in depth. There's a helpful paradigm, I guess, for understanding this that I think it was from Paul Tripp. Years ago, he wrote a book about how people change. And basically, he set up this paradigm for how people change. And he says the first thing that how God begins his process of change in people's lives is that he brings about certain circumstances in their lives. He brings about what Paul Tripp labeled heat. These are things, circumstances, that bring about a particular condition in your life or a situation in your life that is designed by God to expose what's going on in your heart. So the paradigm that Tripp uses is just four words: heat, thorns, cross, and fruit. And what he means by this is that when you encounter the heat in your life, when God cranks the oven up or turns the heat on full blast, and you're exposed to some circumstance that you didn't expect, it could be a good one, it could be a bad one, you're exposed to that type of intense heat or circumstance, it brings things out in your life that you didn't know were there. So the circumstance brings about a response in you that is either fruitful or it's filled with thorns. It's contaminated by sin or corruption or something like that. And God is gracious and merciful to do this, to bring about those circumstances in our life, to cause us to see what's really going on in our hearts, to cause us perhaps to wonder if we truly trust and believe the promises of God, if we're truly focused solely on Him, focused on what He wants for our lives, and not necessarily what we want. God is gracious to bring these situations out, and He often uses those circumstances to expose our sinful attitudes that need to be changed, which leads us to the cross, where we receive and see the provision that God has made, not only to cover our iniquities, but the provision, the blessings that He's given to us to overcome our thorns, and then that results normally in fruit. So that's the paradigm, and I want you just to kind of keep that in mind as we look at the situation that Abram has found himself in. What is the heat? What is the oven that God has put Abram in to expose his thorns? That is the famine. The famine, God has struck the land with this famine, lack of food, not able to grow crops, not able to feed your livestock, not able to feed your family, take care of your servants. God has struck the land with famine, and it's going to cause Abram, well, it's going to reveal something about Abram. So if you're just going through this storyline and you hear and you see that God has promised to bless Abram, God has promised to make his descendants multiply, God has promised to give him this land, and you're in the land and then you see a famine occur, what is your response to that heat? What is your response to that circumstance? Do you stay in the land, trusting God's promise to provide for you, trusting His word that has promised to bless you and give you this land, or do you leave the land? Or do you seek some other sort of solution to the problem, the circumstances that you found yourself in? So this is the tension that we as Christians are forced to live within. Just think about this. How often do you encounter circumstances in your life that seem to be at odds or inconsistent with what God has revealed in His Word? And what does that cause you to do? Does it cause you to double down and trust what God has revealed in your Word? Or does it cause you to look elsewhere, to look to your own ingenuity, to your own resources, to your own plans, and to come up with your own devices. Do you rely then upon your own reason, rationality, your own strength, or do you trust what God has revealed in His Word? And this is the situation that Abram himself is in. He knows what God has promised. God has spoken to him and given him these blessings of seed and a great name and blessing to the ends of the earth and this divine protection. And yet he looks out and he sees a famine. And you're left having to think and put yourself in Abram's shoes and decide at that moment, what are you going to do? Are you going to stay in the land and trust what God has said? Or are you going to come up with your own plan? Or are you going to fall back on your own resources or perhaps resources of another? So this is what happens. Abram is squeezed by the famine. The heat comes and it brings something out of him. And he leaves the land. This severe famine is the crisis, the crucible that God uses to expose Abram's fear and his lack of faith. So when faced with this severe famine, Abram does not turn to God and seek God. He turns instead to Egypt, a land that is rich, nourished by the waters of the Nile, that can sustain itself even in the times of famine. That is where Abram turns. So look at just the first verse. Now there was a famine in the land. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. So this is what he tells us. They're very succinct, kind of a tight description of what happened and then how Abram responded. There is nothing there for us to, the only thing that we could do is we can kind of read into what is going on here. What does the author leave out? What would we expect for him to include? And what does he actually describe? Now just notice, the famine is severe in the land. This is going to be something that's repeated multiple times throughout Genesis. This is how the people of Abraham, his descendants, are actually going to end up in Egypt at the end of Genesis because of the severe famine in the land. But there seems to be no description here of what Abram was thinking when this situation occurred, when the circumstances happened. We can presume to think that he must have thought that there's food in Egypt. Perhaps he saw traders traveling through the land, bringing back supply from Egypt. Perhaps he saw other Canaanites in the land going down to Egypt because they knew that there was food there. We're just simply not told how he knew that, except that he went down there to sojourn there during the time of the famine. So what's missing then? Well, Abram, there is no mention here of God directing Abram to leave the land. So there are occasions later on in the Bible where there is a famine and God tells them where to go. Or he tells them where not to go. There is no divine word here directing Abram's path. God is not speaking. Apparently God is not speaking to describe how Abram should respond to the famine. And notice that there is no description here of Abram asking God for what he ought to do. There is no worship. There is no calling upon the name of the Lord, which was what we see in the first section. There is simply a description of what Abram did in the midst of the circumstance. So Abram sees the famine and takes matters into his own hands and says, well, I have to do something because all of these people depend upon me for their provision. So he goes down to the land of Egypt. So there's no divine guidance. There's no prayer seeking God's guidance. There's in light of the promises that God has given, we can perhaps make a very reasonable conclusion that Abram would have been totally faithful to God if he had remained in the land, trusting that God would provide. So I think in one sense, the silence here is speaking loudly. God is showing us that Abram, even in his intentions to leave the land, leaving the land of blessing, is probably not a good idea. Now, there is an indication here that Abram may be thinking more pragmatically than simply thinking about how he can survive. That idea there of him sojourning. So to sojourn in the land, which would mean that he is recognizing that he's not making Egypt his homeland. He's not deciding that he's just going to leave the land of promise and then set up camp and stay in Egypt. He is going to go there temporarily. He's going to go there as a stranger, and he's going to simply stay there until the famine is over, and then he's going to come back to the land. Now, just using our own minds, thinking humanly, so that seems like a very reasonable response, right? You see what needs to be done. You see how it can be done. You see that this is what God has given you common sense, and it just seems like if you want to survive, then you go to the place where there's food. You don't decide that you're going to stay there forever, but you can go there temporarily, and then you're going to come back, and then God can kind of resume his plan and bring about blessing in the land and cause you to be blessed in the land. So it seems to make sense for us at that human level, right? But is it a good idea? Going down to Egypt often in the Bible is not a good idea. It's actually something that the prophets warn Israel about. Think about Isaiah. Isaiah judges those who look to Egypt for help. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help, rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and horsemen because they are very strong. But they do not look to the Holy One of Israel or consult the Lord. He calls them stubborn children who set out to go to Egypt without asking for my direction, to take refuge in the protection of Pharaoh and to seek shelter in the shadow of Egypt. Look, why would God warn his people not to go to Egypt? Why? Because Egypt is a false hope. Egypt is a superpower, and it's natural and it makes sense for people to align themselves with the superpower if they want that protection, they want that security, they want that provision, that support. Let's go to those who are the strongest. But God says they're stubborn children. Why? Because they're not consulting the Lord. They're not looking to the Lord. This is a false hope. Now this is interesting. In Psalm 33, the psalmist, in light of this distinction being made between relying upon the strength of armies, this is what God says to those who rely upon him. The eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. So even in the midst of that temptation, the common sense approach to this is that we must look to those who can provide food, because if I don't have food, I'm going to die. God says he looks upon those who look to him so that he can provide, deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. Psalm 33, 19 and 20. So just put yourself in this situation. Where do you turn when God cranks up the heat in your life? When God puts you in the crucible, when he brings about circumstances in your life, where do you turn? If you're placed into a position of desperate need, where do you turn for help? Whom do you turn to for help? What do you turn to for help? I think we're all like Abram. I think this is great because Abram, in the first part of chapter 12, we look at him and we think, well, what would it be like to move at 75 across Palestine with a lot of livestock and a barren wife, and to go somewhere where you've never been before, all because God told you to go. That's an Abram that we can't really relate to, right? Even though in biblically speaking, we share the faith of Abraham. We look to the Lord, the one that we cannot see, to go to a land that we don't know, we have never been, that we know and we trust His promises that He will bring us there. But this Abram is, man, he is just like us. This is the human Abram, right? Looking to his own resources, trusting his own plan, devising his own scheme, going to and taking matters into his own hands. So he's faced with this situation. We don't see him praying. We don't see God's guidance. We just see him act. We just see him respond, do what he ought to do to provide for his people. This is the human Abram. But this is not the Abram of faith. This is the faltering, the stumbling, the failing Abram. And we see this more and more as we go and look at the what happens next. You can imagine what would it be like for Abram to go and to sojourn. Just kind of speculating a little bit here. What would it be like for him to go there? What would make him, just imagine he goes there, he gets what he wants, right? So you decide to take matters, you're faced with a particular circumstance, you decide to take matters into your own hands, you do what you think is best, using your sense and your reason, you do what you think is best and you provide for yourself in whatever way that is, and then you actually get what you want. At that point, what is going to cause you to turn to the Lord to look to Him and help for help? No, you've kind of done it yourself. So what's going to happen to Abram when he goes to Egypt? He's going to get food. He's going to get rich. He's going to have security and safety. Why would he ever leave? This is the problem, right? When we don't look to the Lord, when we don't trust Him, when we don't look to Him for our hope and for His guidance and consult Him, what happens? We get what we want sometimes, and we start to like it. We go to Egypt and we start to like Egypt. The longer we stay in Egypt, the more Egypt grows on us. And we start to think, this is not as bad of a place as I thought it was going to be. I kind of like it here. It would be a great place to raise a family. There's plenty of food, the housing is cheap, and we can tour the pyramids whenever we want. And you start to think, well, maybe I don't need to be in the land that God promised to give me, because I can have that here. And or maybe God doesn't need to use me anymore, or I don't want Him to use me anymore. I can just let Him use somebody else. I think this is where we get into trouble, and we can even go so far as to say that we think God is actually saying something different to us now than He did back in at the beginning of our lives. Well, maybe I didn't hear God correctly. Maybe He didn't say He would give me this land or give this land to my offspring. Maybe He said He's going to give that land to my offspring. And maybe we even say, you can imagine Abram having this conversation with Sarai, but you know, I think God is calling us to stay in Egypt. I think God is saying that this is the place of blessing now, right? Well, look it up. Here's the proof. We have lots of livestock. We have all the food that we need. We have security of a superpower nation. Maybe God just wants us to be here. How many times have you heard people say or use that excuse to justify some sort of sinful action? Well, God told me to leave my wife. Now, we do end up there very frequently when we take matters into our own hands and we want to justify our decisions and make excuses and use God to justify what we're finding pleasure in. Abram may have never intended to stay in Egypt permanently, He was just going to go there to sojourn, but you just never know what's going to happen when he gets there. Saying goes that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Now, I do think that he would have stayed there unless certain situations came about. But that's for later. So, let's see. What is his plan then in going to Egypt? He thinks this through. He decides they're going to go. And on their way, something else comes into his mind, right? He recognizes that Egypt may not be a safe place for me. Now, he's going here because he thinks that there's going to be a solution to the famine. It's going to provide a solution to one problem. But then another problem is going to crop up, which is that he has this beautiful wife that other people are going to clearly recognize that she is just so incredibly beautiful that they're going to actually kill him because of it so that they can take her for himself. So that's Abram's fear as they're about to enter into Egypt. So he makes the decision to go to Egypt, and along the way, he thinks about the situation that they're going to be in when they get to Egypt, and he devises this plan. And this plan serves as Abram's first recorded words in the Bible. Now that is surprising. We've seen his actions described by Moses. We've seen what he does in faith to believe God's promise and to leave his homeland and to go to the land that God is going to give him. We see that faith described, but what comes out of Abram's mouth, what his first words then, is this scheme that he comes up with. So this is the plan, and the story focuses more on his scheme than it does on his actions going to Egypt. Look at his plan. Look at what's going to happen. So he's left with the decision he makes to flee the famine, to go to Egypt, and he resorts to his own scheme to save his skin. This is what he says. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, "I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake." So what do we make of Abram's first words? When the man of faith, the patriarch, the patriarch of Israel, when the man God has chosen to bring his blessings to the nations, when he speaks, what do we think? How do we evaluate his words? Not usually when people speak, their first words are just so adorable. Your just heart is full of, you just want to grab them and squeeze them. But when Abram speaks, we're kind of repulsed by it, right? It's not very cute. What do they show us about Abram? They show us that he's a coward who persuades others to lie for his benefit and uses his own wife for his advantage. Not a very flattering picture. Abram's first recorded words in the Bible expose his fear, his desire to deceive or mislead, and his preoccupation with his own self-interest and self-importance at the expense of that of his wife. So Abram, the man of extraordinary faith in the beginning of chapter 12, is a man of faltering faith by the end of it. Now, I don't know, you can go into this a lot. We'll just look at what do his words show us about him. It shows us once that he fears death. Right? He's thinking about how this is going to affect himself. He's placed into the crucible. He decides to go to Egypt, and on his way to Egypt, he thinks only of himself. They're going to see that you're beautiful, and if I'm your husband, then they're going to want to kill me because your beauty is just so compelling. They're going to kill me, and they're going to take you for themselves. So Abram fears the Egyptians. He fears what man can do to him. What about God's promise? Right? There doesn't seem to be any awareness here that he's even thinking about what God has just told him he's going to do, which doesn't seem to indicate that includes killing him or having him killed. So he's thinking, he's fearing death, he's fearing what man can do to him. What else? He resorts to deception or half-truths and lying and coming up with his scheme. Now, there's a lot that's been kind of written about this. This is the first of three so-called sister stories in Genesis that all describe Abraham's going to do it again, and then his son Isaac is going to do it just like this. They're going to come up with a scheme to tell some other foreign power, foreign people that the wife is actually the sister, and then this is actually a way for them to haggle over the bride price for the sister. So instead of killing the patriarch and taking the wife, if Abraham sets himself up as the brother to Sarai, then he can haggle with those who want to marry her, and then they can decide upon how he can benefit from that decision or that haggling. And it's true that Sarah is his sister, technically his half-sister. She is the daughter of his dad, but not his mom. We learn that in the next sister story in Genesis chapter 20. So he's not necessarily lying, but he is clearly not telling the whole truth. He is deceiving and misleading by not sharing all that he knows about Sarai. Yes, she is his sister, but she is his wife. And the text makes that abundantly clear, both here and then in Pharaoh's response. So Abram is not like David describes himself as a man of integrity, living before the Lord in uprightness, as we read in Psalm 26. Abram is willing to resort to deception to get what he wants, to save his own skin. Now what else? Abram acts with self-interest. Like, look, notice, say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you. So this is Abram thinking how he can benefit from this situation. If we come up with this plan and you say that you're my sister, I'll be your brother, and then when they're all going to see how beautiful you are, and when they approach me, because dad's not in the picture, when they approach me, we're going to be able to decide upon the bride price. We're going to decide upon the dowry that's paid now to Abram. So Abram is thinking about his own well-being. This is exactly what God promised to do for him, though, right? God promised to bless him, which means not just blessing his descendants or his offspring, but it does mean blessing him and being causing fruitfulness to come upon him in every sense of the word. But Abram now, because of the situation that he's found himself in, the decision that he's made, is now having to come up with his own scheme to get the blessing, so that things would go well with him. You can imagine Abram sitting Sarai down saying, okay, I think we can benefit from this. We're going to Egypt and there'll be enough food for us to survive, but I think we can probably get a little bit more if you say that you're my sister. And then they'll come to me and then we can figure out, you know, what we can get in return for you, and you can see how this would just bless our family. And you can see the scheming, right? You can kind of see how he's using this situation for his own benefit. He's only thinking about himself. Now, even look at the last part of verse 13. What does he do? He acts with self-interest. He acts with self-importance. Say that you're my sister so that things would go well for me. And that my life may be spared for your sake. Now, this is where he plays off of perhaps Sarai's fears, right? What would it be like for a single woman in the land of a beautiful single woman in the land of Egypt? Well, probably the same way it would be like for a beautiful young woman in Chicago or something, or some other dangerous place, right? You don't want to send your daughter, your beautiful daughter, to live in a place where her life is going to be, where it's dangerous for her to live. So Abram's spinning this now, that if it's going to go well for me, he's trying to convince Sarai of the scheme, if it's going to go well for me, then it's actually going to be good for you. You don't want them to kill me, right? Because if they kill me, then you're going to be vulnerable. You're going to be placed in a dangerous situation. So he decides that he's going to lie to the Egyptians about Sarai, his wife, and she's going to be perhaps taken into someone else's house. Who is making her vulnerable? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. But this is his scheme. Interesting thing is Sarai is silent through the entire episode, right? She doesn't say a word. She seems to go along with Abram's actions. She goes with him to Egypt. She is recognized. I mean, things happen almost exactly like Abraham expected that they would happen. They enter Egypt. The Egyptians see that she's beautiful. What seems to be a situation that he didn't account for is the fact that Pharaoh's rulers, his co-leaders, if you will, they recognize the princes of Pharaoh. They recognize her beauty, and then they talk about her to Pharaoh. Like, she must have just been outstandingly beautiful. Not the Egyptians see it, and then the princes see it, and then they're so enamored with her beauty that they tell Pharaoh about it. And Pharaoh's like, man, she is beautiful. I've never seen a Chaldean that looks like this before, right? So Pharaoh becomes enamored with her. And then what happens? She's taken into Pharaoh's house. Pharaoh's house. Not an Egyptian's house, not a prince's house, but she's taken into Pharaoh's house, the most powerful man in the world. And he is treated well, right? He is blessed. For her sake, he dealt well with Abram. So Abram's plan is, man, it's coming to pass. The scheme is, in a sense, it's working. Abram is getting blessed. He's not killed. He gets blessed, a sevenfold blessing, sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants, female donkeys, and even camels. So Abram is blessed. Things go well for him. But what's the problem? Sarai is in Pharaoh's house. Sarai is, at this point, untouchable. Right? So just put yourself in the situation. We're just going to speculate again. Just think about this. From a human level, Abram has taken matters into his own hands. He sees and senses that going into Egypt is going to be perhaps potentially dangerous for him. So he comes up with his own scheme. And he schemes this up and he thinks this through. And things happen according to his plan. And now where is he at the end of verse 16? Where is Abram? Abram doesn't have a wife anymore. She's a part of someone else's harem. And everybody seems to speculate that Pharaoh is simply adding her in to his other wives and concubines. So she has just been brought in like any other beautiful woman. Abram has been blessed. He's in Egypt. He sees the plan kind of come to fruition. But where is he? Like, put yourself in his shoes. What would be going through your head? Here's two possible things that could be going through your head. Perhaps more, right? You're here, you see things come to pass, and you may think, man, this turned out really good. I couldn't have planned this any better. I love it when a plan comes together, and this came together like no other plan I've ever had before. This is exactly what I was thinking. This is more than what I was thinking was going to take place. And perhaps he's glad that Sarai's gone. You know, he's been given all of these new servants. He's been given female servants. Maybe one is named Hagar. And maybe he starts to have an eye for Hagar, and Sarai's just forgotten at this point. Maybe that's where Abram is. Or maybe he sees the blessing He sees the bounty that Pharaoh has given to him. And maybe he starts to think and wonder, well, wait a second. What? Didn't God say he was going to bless me? Didn't God say he was going to give me this land? Didn't God say he was going to protect me and give me a multitude? How can I have a multitude of offspring if I don't have my wife? And then he starts to think and starts to see and he starts to understand and realize what it is that he has done. My God, what have I done? Look where this has gotten me. Sarah's in an impenetrable fortress. Pharaoh's house. I can't go and get her out. I have nothing to exchange for her. I've jeopardized God's promises. Look at the mess that I've gotten myself into. Look at my how I've made these decisions. Look at how I haven't trusted in God. Look at how I've faltered in my faith. I've deceived those around me. This is how Daniel Fuller summarizes this. He says, Abram was in Egypt without Sarah. He had painted himself into a corner. There was no possibility from a human vantage point for getting out of Egypt to the place where God would fulfill his promise. For how could Sarah ever be extricated from Pharaoh's harem? So desperate was Abram's plight that he could have known of no formula by which he could escape. Like Paul, he could only say, "What a wretched man I am. Who will rescue me?" So that's perhaps what Abram's thinking. We don't know that. We don't have to know that because we live through that, right? We've all gone through that where we've schemed up some plan and we've gotten something that we've wanted and we realize that wasn't the best for us and that wasn't what God had wanted. And we've gone about it through deceitful ways. So we don't need the author to tell us that. So what's going to happen? Well, the only thing that can happen, right? The only thing that can happen is that God would intervene. God told Abram, the Lord had told Abram, given him promises to stay in the land. Abram leaves the land and goes to Egypt without consulting the Lord. Without asking for God's guidance, he comes up with his own scheme, and there's no indication that God is anywhere near Abram until we get to verse 17 when we see that God is going to intervene now to deliver Sarai out of the problem that Abram has created. She has kind of gone along with. The only possible solution to this problem is that God would intervene. And what does he do? This is incredible, but the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Now, one would think that there doesn't seem to be any indication that Pharaoh did anything wrong, even though I think that they do recognize that. He seems to be acting out of ignorance, that he truly believed that Sarai was Abram's sister, like he had been told. And he now, because of these plagues, he comes to recognize that Sarai is actually not his sister, but his wife. And he seems to be more concerned about that than Abram. So one would expect, because Abram seems to be the one, the guilty party in this matter, God would afflict him with plagues. But instead, God afflicts Pharaoh with plagues, strikes him with plagues, boils of some sort perhaps, we don't know, but strikes Pharaoh and Pharaoh's house with plagues. Because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Now, why does the Lord do that? Again, this is challenging. But I think what we see here is that God is acting in accordance with his promises. His promise is to what? It's to bless Abram. Now, Abram, in one sense, has gotten God into a difficult position, because Abram has been the one who's deceived and lied and kind of schemed up his own plan. But because of God's promises, he has to actually afflict and strike Pharaoh to protect his plan. What happens at this point? Or what could happen? Sarai could stay in Pharaoh's harem, and God's plan could come to an end. He'd have to start all over again. But what keeps God, what makes God intervene, is the promises that he's made. So God, even though Abram has not acted in faith towards God's promises, God has acted faithful to his promises. He strikes Pharaoh, protects Sarai, and drives Abram out back into the land. So what do we take from this story then? I think we can look at it merely as kind of a moral lesson. There's certainly a lot of that going on, right? Certainly Abram here is not, so this is kind of one of those authentic portraits of a man of faith. Abram does not demonstrate faith just maxed out for the duration of his life ever since the moment he believed in God's word and followed him to the land of promise. Abram waffles, he falters, he fails, he stumbles, and he continues to grow in faith. He continues, as Romans says, he continues to grow in faith as he gives glory to God. This isn't, even though this is the first time that Abram speaks this deceitful scheme, and he's going to do it again, this isn't the last word that we have from Abram. Now, I think if we were merely looking at it as a way to enforce a moral lesson or a moral principle, then we would have to say that the patriarchs didn't get it because they repeat the same thing over and over again. How is it that we're supposed to get the lesson? The problem is we know what we ought to do. That we so often act like a faithless Abram, taking matters into our own hands, making decisions on our own without consulting the Lord, departing from his promises and relying upon other things. So, it's not simply a moral lesson, but it does show us something about the true hero of the story. It shows us about what the Lord does when his people get into a hot mess. When his people cause his plan to be jeopardized, what does God do? God keeps his word over and over and over again. God keeps his promises. Even though his people are faithless, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. His word is true. He sends it forth, accomplishing what it will. His plans, his schemes, his desires, his counsels remain fixed, steadfast, firm forever. Because God cannot change what he has said or go back on what he said or promised. I love the fact that you can look how this story seems to get repeated, not just in the sister stories, but the themes here. This is an early foreshadowing of what we see later in the Bible about a greater exodus. God's people are going to go to Egypt because of a famine. The lives of the male children will be threatened, but the daughters will survive. God is going to intervene to bring judgments, and that's going to cause Pharaoh to cast God's people out of the land. And they're going to go out and they're going to go back to the land ultimately in worship. This anticipates what we see happening in the Exodus. So in one sense, as God's people, enslaved in Egypt for 400 years, they're going to read this story. And what are they going to remember? They're going to remember that God got Abram out of Egypt and kept his plan alive, preserved Sarai. Promises are continuing, and they're going to think for themselves that if he did it for Abram, he's going to do it for us. We're going to be brought out of the land Even if it takes 400 years, we're going to be brought out of the land, and God is going to bring us into His land, and we're going to worship Him there. But it also is a beautiful depiction of what the Lord Jesus has accomplished for us. That Exodus story, that Exodus paradigm, what we see here in miniature, anticipating the greater one, actually that one depicts and anticipates something even greater. What the Lord Jesus would do for His enslaved people. What the Lord Jesus would do for us who seem to always get ourselves into a hot mess. What happens? Well, the only thing that can possibly happen. We are in a worse situation than Abraham. We've caused the mess. We've made this mess with our own hands, relying upon our own devices and schemes and lies and deceit and fear. That's the situation that we get ourselves into all the time. And the only possible solution is for the Lord to intervene. And instead of the Lord intervening and striking someone else, the Lord intervened and took the brunt of the plagues. He took our strikes. He was stricken for us. Smitten, stricken, and afflicted. Who is it that has sinned? The slave has sinned, but the son has suffered. Right? So we get into that situation, the works of our own hands, our own devices and schemes, and yet God intervenes, bears our punishment, takes upon Himself the plagues of His own wrath, in fulfillment of the promises, and rescues us out of them. Brings us into the land to worship Him. So we can thank Him appropriately for that. Let's do so now.